from the Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. We're offering you a special program this week, devoted almost exclusively to a new publication by the Organization of American Historians, The Best Essays in American History, 2006. As you'll soon hear, these essays represent some of the best scholarship produced by historians of the United States between the summer of 2004 and the summer of 2005. The editor of that collection is historian Joyce Appleby, and I'll be discussing best essays with her in a few moments. But first, as we do every week, let's take a look at some recent articles in the news you may have missed, all of which relate to U.S.-Canadian history. Believe it or not, the United States actually has a plan to invade Canada. According to a recent Washington Post article, it's a 94-page document titled Joint Army and Navy Basic War Plan, Red. Its goal is to seize and annex our neighbor to the north. First, we would send a joint Army-Navy overseas force to capture the port city of Halifax, cutting the Canadians off from their British allies. Then we would seize Canadian power plants near Niagara Falls, followed by a three-front invasion, from Vermont to take Montreal and Quebec, out of North Dakota to capture the railroad center at Winnipeg, and from the Midwest to capture the strategic nickel mines of Ontario. In the meantime, the U.S. Navy would seize the Great Lakes and blockade Canada's Atlantic and Pacific ports. It may be either shocking or a joke to many of you, depending upon your point of view, but it is a real plan. It was drawn up and approved by the War Department in 1930, and it was designed for a war with England, no less, in the event hostilities developed between the United States and England over international trade. Of course, it wouldn't have been the first time the U.S. invaded Canada. In another story in the news, this one in the Toronto Star, a Canadian filmmaker has launched a crusade to stop U.S. treasure hunters from scavenging the wreck of the HMS Phantom, which many believe was returning to Halifax with loot from the White House and Capitol building when she sank on November 24, 1814. This was during the War of 1812, of course, and the British had just sacked Washington, D.C. It's not beyond imagination to see silverware stolen from the White House end up for sale on eBay, said John Wesley Chisholm, who hopes to make a documentary film about the site. The province should revoke or suspend the license for this site. On a larger scale, he added, the entire Treasure Trove Act should be abolished. Curtis Sprouse, founder of the salvage company Sovereign Exploration Associates International, opposes any such move, explaining that his company is dedicated to uncovering and preserving history and bringing it to the public. And finally, hundreds of Canadian and British soldiers held as prisoners of war during the American Revolution lie buried in a Pennsylvania farm field that is now the focus of a bitter legal battle between a housing developer and historic preservationists. The struggle over the former site of Camp Security, a sprawling prison compound near the present-day city of York, that was used to house captured redcoats between 1781 and 1783, recently resulted in its being named one of the top 10 most threatened historic places in the United States. Proponents hope to turn the site into an international memorial and tourist attraction. Those fighting to save Camp Security, the country's only surviving prison site from the Revolutionary War, believe the undisturbed acreage contains a wealth of 18th-century artifacts and the graves of hundreds of prisoners who died when a typhus epidemic swept through the camp in 1782. I'm sure there are many Canadians whose ancestors were there, commented Melinda Higgins, executive director of Historic York. This story is internationally significant. The uproar over the Pennsylvania site follows a similar struggle in Canada that resulted in the creation of a commemorative park for captured U.S. troops who were held at a Nova Scotia prison camp during the War of 1812. About 200 U.S. soldiers died in captivity and were buried on Dead Man's Island in Halifax, where a group of residents rallied to stop proposed development that would have obliterated the burial ground. When we return, I'll be discussing The Best Essays in American History 2006 with Joyce Appleby in this special edition of Talking History. The Organization of American Historians has just published The Best Essays in American History 2006, the first in what the OAH hopes to be a series of such annual volumes published with Palgrave Press. Best Essays makes available to the public a select number of articles published between the summer of 2004 and 2005, and much like Talking History, it's intended to bring the best American history scholarship to a wider audience, which is to say, beyond academe. Our guest this week, Joyce Appleby, one of the nation's leading American historians in her own right, edited the collection. Joyce is a professor emerita at the University of California, Los Angeles, as well as a past president of the OAH. She's also co-director of the History News Service, in which capacity she facilitates historians writing op-eds for newspapers, many of which have been aired here on Talking History, providing valuable historical content for issues in the news. Welcome, Joyce.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to return to Talking History.
It's good to have you. You edited the volume, but you didn't work alone. You had a selection committee consisting of nine other leading American historians, but perhaps you could explain how the selection process worked.
Yes, it's interesting because I think most people would be astounded at how many articles are published every year on topics in American history, from popular magazines to state quarterlies to specialized journals and the history of law, the history of medicine, or journals that deal with specific groups like women or African Americans. The committee, the nine-person committee, actually canvassed over 300 journals, that is to say all the articles published in that year in 300 journals. And each member of the committee was given a section of that array of journals. Then they could nominate four articles to be considered for the final 10. And those articles, the 36 articles that were nominated, were read by all the members of the committee. And slowly the 10 were winnowed away from this collection of 36 articles. Not every article possessed all the merits in equal measure, but every one of them had possessed a clarity, a coherence, an accessibility, and excellence in research and thought and writing.
Well, it's a mind-boggling amount of work.
It was.
Boy. Okay, so let's talk about these essays. Start with the first one. Joe Ellis, Inventing the American Presidency. He was on the show just a couple weeks ago talking about his new book, His Excellency. So I wasn't surprised to see that his essay is about Washington. But assuming that our listeners remember a little bit about what he had to say, let me ask you a slightly different question than I might ordinarily, which is, why do you think people are still interested in reading about Washington after everything that's come out?
People are still interested in reading everything in the founding era. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. I think because history plays such a role in binding the citizens of the United States together. We haven't lived long in the land, but we do have some core values that were enunciated during the American Revolution. We also have a cluster of really outstanding leaders for the period that extends from the Revolution, say, through Jefferson's election. And I think that makes this period eternally interesting, appealing to readers. What Joseph Ellis is able to do in this article is demonstrate how new the government of the United States created by the Constitution was in 1789 when George Washington became the first president. And what he very deftly details is what did Washington draw upon to form his government and to set precedents. And he says that it's his experience as a plantation owner of a large plantation and also his having been general of the Continental Army. So these are executive positions, and Washington drew on that experience. He didn't like political wrangling, and so he was able to keep a lid on that. He also introduced the idea of the cabinet meetings, and he held weekly receptions that impressed upon the elite society in New York City, which was then the capital, of the importance of the new United States government.
Now, the second essay deals with Federalist 10, among the many essays written after the U.S. Constitution was reported out of the Philadelphia Convention to explain the document to people who would have to ratify it through voting. Woody Holton writes an essay that you included, and what did he have to say?
Well, like the piece on Washington, Federalist 10 is a topic that has been visited over and over and over again, but Woody Holton found something very fresh to discuss. Federalist 10 was always seen as the most important of the 88 Federalist Papers because in that, James Madison, often called the father of the Constitution, laid out why a larger geographic area with many more people would be safer for democracy than a small area. And he does this by pointing out how difficult it would be to form a majority faction. This majority faction was another name for the turbulence that had marked democracy in the past, and it was a possibility that really worried those gentlemen, and they almost all were gentlemen, who were forming the new United States Constitution. What Holton is able to show is that Madison was not alone in worrying about how popular turbulence was going to affect the new United States government. And he goes through state ratification debates and demonstrates that one of the key issues was how large the congressional districts ought to be. And should Congress members be voted by district or in a general state election? And the debates show how very important this idea of controlling majorities from doing things that were against the best interest of the nation was. And it brings out the conservatism, but also the sense of responsibility that these men had in forming the new government.
Okay. Leslie Swaum and Carl Osthaus, I believe that's the pronunciation, take us into the 19th century with their essays. Tell us about those two essays.
Well, Schwamm has a very interesting study of the migration of free blacks into the North after emancipation and the 13th Amendment. It's interesting because most Reconstruction articles deals with the South, but here Schwamm looks at Illinois and Iowa and shows how the appearance of many free blacks led to serious discussions and sometimes very prejudiced debates about how these newcomers, these new migration, were going to affect the state. And what he finds is that both the demonstration of racism that was characteristic of the South, but also enunciations of how important universal education was going to be in integrating these new citizens into the United States. The piece by Osthaus deals with the Southern, what he calls the plain folk of the South. The book is called The Work Ethic of Plain Folk, Labor and Religion in the Old South. And it draws upon the work of a German philosopher, Max Weber, who wrote a very famous essay called The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. Sort of catch the flavor of the essay in that title, because heretofore, people interested in the emergence of capitalism looked at material forces, and Weber said, no, you've got to look at culture, you've got to look at the acquisition of new habits and new attitudes. And this led to the interest in Protestant churches, which were very concerned with individual responsibility and freedom of action and individualism in general, and this was seen as very important to the emerging capitalist form of economy. What Osthaus does is look at the plain folk of the South and see that they too had this Protestant ethic that was so important to capitalism, that it wasn't just confined to Northern Americans.
Let me just take a minute to remind our listeners, in case they tuned in late, that this is Talking History, and I'm Brian LeBeau, and I'm speaking with Joyce Appleby, the editor of The Best Essays in American History, 2006, published by the Organization of American Historians with Palgrave Press. Danielle McGuire takes this whole idea of race relations in the South and pushes it into a rather sensitive direction here, talking about the role that the rape of black women by Southern white men played in the domination and the subjection of African Americans. Tell us a bit more about that essay.
Well, let me give the title because it tells a lot. It was like all of them had been raped, sexual violence, community mobilization, and the African-American freedom struggle. The focus of her article is the rape of a black woman in Tallahassee, Florida in 1959 by a group of white men that had planned to go find a black woman and rape her, and they laid in wait and attacked a car of Florida A&M students in tuxedos and formal gowns who were just returning from a ball, and they were able to grab one woman, the other got away, and she is raped. What was remarkable about this was that an all-white jury convicted four men of this vicious rape, and McGuire uses this sensational event and the very promising idea of a conviction by an all-white jury to show how rape became known then as one of the weapons in the white domination of black people in the South. Rape was not only an attack on women, it was an attack on the men who were helpless to protect them. And it's a hard article in many ways to read, but it's a very powerful description of rape as a weapon in this struggle against black assertions of rights, and then this trial as a weapon in declaring that the black women were not going to tolerate this anymore.
I would think that would resonate and get a lot of readers, because every day we pick up the newspaper and see how rape continues to be used in warfare around the world.
That's right, and finally it's being considered as a war crime, where for centuries it never was.
Right. Now, Eric Avila takes us in a new direction, new area of involvement, popular entertainment. He takes a look at forms of popular entertainment after World War II. What's his point?
Well, I think it's very interesting. Again, the title is illuminating. It's popular culture in the age of white flight, film noir, Disneyland, and the Cold War, a suburban imaginary. What he shows is that you can study something like white flight from cities and the creation of suburbia in America, which does take place after the Second World War. You can study them through movies as well as through theme parks, and he sees popular culture distills many of the fears and attitudes that drove many white families from the cities and created what they hoped was going to be a white utopia in the suburbs.
Okay. Charlotte Brooks takes us out to your neighborhood, to California, and talks about residential integration, or not, during the Cold War. What's she writing about?
Yes, that's very interesting. Well, she begins with a U.S. Supreme Court decision in 1948, Shelley versus Kramer, that ruled that restrictive covenants in real estate contracts could not be enforced. These restrictive covenants were usually directed against some minority group, Jews, blacks, Chinese, Japanese, Americans. And she just finds a wonderful story that took place in San Francisco, a wonderful story and yet a very sad outcome. In this story, Sing Sheng, a Chinese American, wanted to move into Southwood, and he actually bought a house in this white neighborhood, but he received a threatening letter, and so I should say it was about his prospective purchase. He hadn't yet purchased the house, and he asked his neighbors, people in this community, to vote on whether or not they wanted him and his family to move into Southwood. They did vote, and he lost. But the incident drew nationwide attention, and there were positive expressions of support for his quest for integration into a white neighborhood in San Francisco. And the incident, with its national exposure, also brought up how the United States in the 50s and 60s was moving to have more intimate relations across the Pacific with Asian countries, and how much our racial behavior or our prejudice in the country was going to influence those foreign policy initiatives.
Now, these stories make it so attractive. But you write in your introduction that one of the most fascinating, taxing, and rewarding efforts historians undertake is tracking down elusive clues about historical figures. And then you reference Ralph Luker's essay, and maybe you could tell us a little bit about that. What did he track down?
This is the historian as a sleuth, and what Luker looks into is the legend of Vernon Johns. Vernon Johns was a black activist. He was the predecessor of Martin Luther King Jr. at the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama, but he was a man who attracted attention and indeed some mythic events. And what Luker does is to look at everything that had been said about Johns, also interviewed some relatives, and because of his vast experience doing African-American history, Luker was able to sort out a lot of fiction from fact in these stories about Johns and Johns' father and Johns' grandfathers, both black and white, and recover a pretty accurate story about Johns' life, and you get along the way the creation of this myth about Vernon Johns.
Interesting. Now, Thomas Sugrue's essay deals with something I think most of our listeners or your readers will be familiar, affirmative action and civil rights, but he takes it, let's say, in a different, even unique direction or approach. Tell us about his essay.
Right. In his Affirmative Action from Below, Civil Rights, the Building Trades, and the Politics of Racial Equality in the United States, 1945 to 69, Sugrue looks at Philadelphia, and he follows the initiative of the Nixon administration in enforcing equal opportunity in the building trades. But what he does then is to break with the orthodox view of affirmative action as a top-down expansion of regulatory power and show the work of local members of the Philadelphia community and how they had been working on this issue of employment discrimination dating back to the Depression and had used World War II as an event, as a historical period in which they could push forward more briskly this long quest for equal opportunity in employment.
Interesting. The last essay by Matthew Lassiter writes about the emergence of a white backlash to desegregation during the nation's first mandated busing in Charlotte, North Carolina. So tell us about that.
It's an exploration of the rhetoric and the facts and the coalitions and the activism of both those people who were for busing and for integration, purposes of integration, and those people who were opposed to it. And he shows how middle class goals of respectability and security were, you might say, exploited to gain a group of people to oppose busing, but also he shows at the same time that there was a resurgence of expressions of belief in education as a means to equal opportunity and an integrated society, and how the proponents of busing use these. So he just opens up a very rich record of how white Americans responded to the first practical efforts to implement Brown versus Topeka, Kansas, and the integration order for education in the United States.
Okay.
Like all of these articles, and one of the fascinating things is they take small topics, but they open up large panoramas of the American past.
Let me build on that then, because I need to ask you the tough question here. I got to see these essays in galley form and read them one at a time and enjoyed them. But then in reading your introduction, you took on the really difficult question, which is when you look at this collection as a whole, what does it tell us about the writing of American history today? You write about it over the centuries and kind of set up these essays. But anyone who's not a professional reading these essays, what would you tell them about what these essays reflect about the profession at this point?
Well, I think I'd first tell them that the writing of American history has a history itself, which is something that I don't think all readers recognize. In the aftermath of the Revolution, American history was very important as a celebration of the Declaration of Independence and the successful war and the ensuing establishment of a new government under the United States Constitution. So you had a celebratory history, one that focused upon heroes. This history lasted for about a century, but then in the beginning of the 19th century, you had a new topic that emerges, and that was the idea of economic influences in the past. A kind of a stellar book in the history of writing of American history was Charles Beard's An Economic Interpretation of the United States Constitution, and that set off alarms that people would be told that the founding fathers actually had economic interests that were at play in the Revolution and in the drafting of the Constitution. After the Second World War, not only did the topics that were interesting to American history change, but the American historians themselves changed. You had a great expansion in higher education after Sputnik. You had many first-generation members of their families to attend college in not only college but in graduate work. So you had Greek Americans and Italian Americans. You had African Americans for the first time, and you also had women. And this convergence of these newly minted PhDs and an American history which had been limited to really past politics plus economics, this led to a curiosity about American society itself, particularly the unsung members, not necessarily heroes, of that American past. And the rallying cry was history from the bottoms up. And this social history, I think, is reflected in these essays because they are, for the most part, about ordinary people and some of the experiences they had that exemplify this ongoing social struggle of Americans to live up to those core ideals that form the political base.
good setup, and I hope that our listeners, when they get this book, and I hope they will take the time to read your introductions, because it really does set up these essays very well. Otherwise, you're just reading a series of articles that are interesting, but lacking the kind of context that you provided. Good job, and thank you for joining us again.
Well, you're very welcome, and I hope that many people get this volume, because I think they'll learn a lot of fascinating things about their own country.
They will indeed. Thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Joyce Appleby, Professor Emerita at the University of California, Los Angeles, past President of the Organization of American Historians, and editor of Best Essays in American History 2006, published by the Organization of American Historians and Palgrave Press. This is Talking History. That's it for this special edition of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beatty is our producer and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need to do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thanks for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.